You're listening to KTNA Talkeetna, and now for Nuggets, a locally produced program focusing on the northern Susitna Valley. Created by your friends and neighbors at Pothole Productions and Talkeetna Community Radio. From comic relief to serious beliefs, each week brings you a fresh nugget. I'm Holly, and today's show, we're talking with Bruce Gilbert. He has lived in Haines for the last 42 years. He owns a business there, the Haines Home Building Supply and True Value Hardware. And he has some stories to share about Talkeetna in the bygone days. Welcome, Bruce, to the show.
Thank you, Holly. Yes, I first saw Mount McKinley, of course, that's what we called it, in 1951. They had boat trains that would carry people from Fairbanks and the interior down to Seward to meet the train to meet the boat there, and I took the SS Alaska on down south where I lived and was attending college. But on September 10th, 1951, I and my buddy were camped in a two-man mountain tent between the train station there at McKinley Park and the hotel. And we found out that there was a bus trip into the mountain along the road there, the park road, that one could get for $17, which included breakfast, too.
So, what a deal.
Yeah.
What a deal.
Well, it was raining down at the train station, and my buddy didn't want to do it, but I said, well, maybe I'll never come back. And so I think I better take this trip and try my luck.
And were you here just on a vacation?
I mean, No, I was working my way through college by working up in Fairbanks.
Oh, okay. Okay.
In 1951, of course, the Korean War had started, and there was a great demand. And so we went to the employment agency and got jobs as dishwashers out at the Eielson Air Force Base at a construction camp there. And later on, why I ended up with my buddy seeing how much money we could make. And so we were holding down 20 hours of jobs, and I was able to pay back my first year of college education at Washington State, and I made $2,000. We got $2.73 an hour for third-year apprentice carpenters in those days.
That's actually good, very good wages for 1951, isn't it?
That is.
Top dollar.
Right. And on the farm back in Yakima, I could only make a dollar. So I wanted to see Alaska. My mother had filled in as a substitute teacher in Douglas in 1920 when she worked at the University of Washington Placement Office, and the teacher left unexpectedly at Christmas time, and she was called in to fill in. And she told us stories about digging out of the second story windows because the snow was so deep in Douglas. And that was 1920 now. Anyway, so I saw Mount McKinley just after we climbed got over the Polychrome Pass, the first pass. Oh, and the clouds cleared and the sun came out and it was so glorious. I said that was my goal in mountaineering. I had climbed most of the peaks in the Northwest there. My dad was a very active scoutmaster and led many climbs of Troop 9 in there in Yakima. And Charlie Cole was up in Fairbanks, if you remember that name, was amongst them. Anyway, I came back in 52 and 53 to Fairbanks and worked BLM fighting forest fires, which is really a great way to see the country of Alaska. That's the real Alaska out there, away from the towns. Anyway, 54, 55, I was in Korea in the Army. And then I came back, and this friend of mine in Yakima had contacted Walt Gonison, who led the infamous 1956 expedition to try to prove that Dr. Cook was the first one up the mountain. Well, the four of us were flown in by Don Sheldon, your glacier pilot here then, and we landed on the Duluth about 5,500 feet, and we tried several approaches to duplicate Cook's book. He wrote a book, Top of the Continent, when he returned from two good reconnoitering adventures, but not really a climbing adventure. And Bradford Washburn was over on the fake peak at that time with his theodolite and found the fake peak. So when we came back, we were turned around at 11.5 on the East Ridge there. And two of us wanted to go on to try to see if we could do something. And two of the were other doctors. And in looking back, of course, I was only 25 and single and more chancy, I guess, than the other two. So anyway, the good doctors prevailed, and we came back and reported to the Life magazine along with Bradford that, yes, this wasn't the way that Cook could have climbed McKinley.
It could not possibly have happened that way.
He claimed in 8 days that he climbed from the Susitna River to the top. Well, in 1969, there was a party of seven people that took 39 days to do the East Ridge, and they were landed at the 5,500 feet level.
So they had a little cheater bit of a start there on it, and it still took them 39 days.
And in September, when you claim to have climbed it, why, of course, you know what happens to the crevasses up there on the Ruth Glacier or any glacier in Alaska. Anyway.
So was that your very first time in Talkeetna? You drove from Fairbanks down to Talkeetna, and then Don Sheldon took you from
here? Well, now you couldn't drive to Talkeetna. Yeah, we came.
Oh, you're right. It was 1956, right?
Yes.
Yeah. You had to take the railroad.
Had to take the railroad, yeah.
Or fly,
yeah. Mm-hmm. We took the railroad. It was a four-man expedition, Walt Gonison and these two doctors, Dr. Otto Trout and Dr. Paul Gerstmann. These were outside folks, and then myself. Okay, that was the, I'll never forget the Life photographers having hidden earphones to record any messages that we had in regards to the Gunnison, because Walt was flown out 3 days ahead of us, who had to wait the weather, and they were trying to drum up a story about dissension between the captain and the crew, you might say.
Oh, boy.
But anyway.
Well, it makes for good press, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, that's
if they
the
could
good
come
press.
Up with something like that.
So, but poor Mrs. Venner, it's written up in Life magazine in that year, 1956, and it was in July.
Now I'm going to have to get on the internet. I bet you can get that through the internet and go back and read all about it now.
I'm not into the internet, so. Anyway, a couple of years later, I wrote the Seattle Mountaineers because I was unaffiliated and kind of a maverick mountaineer. And so I wrote the Seattle Mountaineers, and they said, nobody going up McKinley, but would you like to try Blackburn? And I said, well, just any way to get back to Alaska. So I joined an expedition to do the second ascent of Mount Blackburn in 1958. And this was led by a Canadian party. And in it was Hans Grimoser, who later started the famous heli-skiing out of the Bugaboos in southeastern B.C. there. Anyway, we tried the East Ridge of Blackburn at first, and I was never in the front, but I could carry a good load. And anyway, that route didn't go, and we turned around and came back down to our base. Oh, I should have mentioned that when we got to Glen Allen in 58, Jack Wilson didn't have any skis on his plane. And how are we going to get into Blackburn without flying in? So I phoned up my friend Don Sheldon, who very accommodatingly came over and ferried us in from Chitna to the Nabesna Glacier on the north side and landed us at about the 5,000 to 6,000 foot level. And then we tried the East Ridge. It didn't work for us, so we came back down to our base camp and the five of us looked for other approaches, and three of them wanted to try a frontal assault. There's a good north face there on Blackburn, But it looked like a wall in the suicide avalanche area to me. So the leader and I stayed back, and we waited a couple hours while the other three molded over, and because we could see a good route up on the northwest ridge that looked quite possible. Well, finally they came back, and we all came to our senses and said, okay, let's give it a go. Most of us were on skis, and so we'll wait a minute here.
We'll finish up the story of Blackburn and then hear about the second phase when you were in Alaska in just a moment. You're listening to Nuggets, and I'm Holly Stinson. Today I'm interviewing Bruce Gilbert, visiting with him from Haines, and he had some early mountaineering experiences here in Alaska in the 50s, and we're in the middle of the story about Mount Blackburn.
Okay, the Mount Blackburn is 16.5, and I left you with trying the northwest ridge on Blackburn, and with Hans Grimoser in the lead, the only obstacle was a gendarme, which was a big ice finger, maybe 100 feet high, that blocked our progress on that side. But he surmounted that very expertly. He was from Austria, and he
climbed up it. When you say he surmounted it, did he climb up it?
Oh yes, we all climbed up it, and he belayed, of course, after he first got up there. And then that was the only obstacle in the whole route, and in 2 days, while we had the top of Blackburn. If you know the history of Blackburn, why it was attempted many times by this young lady out of the East in 1911, I think it was, and she couldn't hire the right miner to carry her loads, and after several trips, why, she really was about to give up, but finally she found the right person, and he carried the loads, and she later married him. But it was an epic, because they started from Kennicott, which is only 1,000 or 2,000 feet high, and they climbed the south side of Blackburn, which is quite a feat, especially in 1911.
Wow.
Anyway, I borrowed the I had a pair of duck hunter's boots that I had vulcanized the Vibrams on the bottom, and unfortunately I took a spill on while skiing back to base camp, and had to buy another pair of boots, and in the meantime I had signed on to an expedition going up the West Buttress route, the Ed Cooper party, we met there in Anchorage, and I didn't have enough time to find a pair of other boots, so I bought these boots from Hans Grimoser, these insulated leather boots, which my tips of my big toes froze, even though I took them to bed every night with me. And this was, okay, now 1958, why Ed Cooper had read in Mountain World, a Swiss publication that did the mountain trips, and he followed the same route that Bradford Washburn took in 1951. So you can see that there was a 7-year lull there. And anyway, we had the mountain to ourselves all the way up, and we, let's see, we were on, I was the only one on skis, I think the rest of them were on snowshoes, but it was a 6-man party, and we started in the middle of June, dawn flew us in, and We skied up the conventional West Buttress route, built an igloo at Windy Corner, I remember. But on skis, I could ski up and be back down and have the stove and hot soup ready for the crew before they could return on snowshoes. So I found skiing to my liking and to quite an advantage.
To your advantage, yeah, that's for sure. A quick descent.
Yes, and it's really, you know, the upper part of the Kilhelton is no problem. And let's see, I think I probably left them at Windy Corner there. I can't remember for sure. But anyway, we were snowshoes and then climbing from there. Now, Bradford Washburn, when he talks of his 51 expedition, they used snow shovels to shovel out the snow. It was so deep in the, I guess you'd call it the wall or the face there, where the present route goes. And we were forced to either cut steps for at least 2,000 feet in elevation or try to scramble up the rock ledges over onto the left of the conventional route. And so this is what we did, and we did get kind of separated from each other. It was a, you know, 3 2-man rope groups. But anyway, we all met up at 16-4. And as I say, this is because of the good weather that we had. And then we went up to 17-2, and then we set up an igloo there, I remember. And then the next day, while we started out, and unfortunately, we ran into some bad weather up on what we thought was the top. Now, I have to say that at your mind at 20,000 feet doesn't exactly work the same as sea level.
It's not quite getting the oxygen that you get at sea level
because
to process things, is it, Bruce?
Right, and we thought we'd seen pictures of the top. But it looked to us like it was the top.
You wanted it to be the
we
top,
wanted it
I'm
to
sure.
be the top. But we came back down to the 17-3 camp, and we looked down below, and here was this party of, I think, six people that were training for Mount Everest. And it was a Wyoming group that unfortunately lost one of their members, Jake Brittenbach, in an ice serac there on the Kumba on Everest a few years later. Anyway, Jake, they cut their steps and they worked and they got right up there in jig time and caught up with us at 17-3. And it was a good thing they did, because one of their party, I think it's Hackett, I'm sure it was Hackett, but I can't remember his first name. Was it Peter? Anyway,
you're doing awfully good at names. I was just going to say, how do you remember all these details?
Well, these names stuck. My memory has faded since then. But he said, "Did you see the flagpoles?"
Flagpoles?
Oh boy!
What flagpoles?
No, we had not seen the flagpoles.
Oh dear!
These are three bamboo poles that Bradford Washburn had taken up there in 51. So, guess what? We hadn't climbed the mountain at all, or the summit, to the true summit. So four of our six started out, and I've got a movie of this here with me, and we were in T-shirts at 17-2 on July 2nd of 58, and here we are starting out in T-shirts. Well, it was a great day for a great climb, and the four of us made it. I remember I got up there about 7 o'clock. Jake and his party had climbed both summits, and they had asked me about possibly going with them, but no, I wasn't of the caliber. Anyway, Bob Elliott was my rope mate. And he was the type of guy that if you dropped your gloves, of course they were tied to us, but if you dropped anything, he would beat you in picking it up. He was just that kind of a guy. Unfortunately, he was killed in the John Day rescue when, unsolicited, he knew the area, and he had this friend, the contractor friend, that had a plane, and they flew over McKinley to drop supplies to the John Day party. Well, Unfortunately, he wasn't a Don Sheldon in flying around the mountain because down they crashed. Aww. And unfortunately, he left a widow and two young kids.
So that's the story of your climb in 58. We'll be back in a moment and hear about the time that you actually lived in Talkeetna in just a moment. And I'm visiting with Bruce Gilbert, a character from Haines who came by the studio yesterday, and we grabbed him to do a Nuggets show with him. He's talked about his mountaineering days here in the 50s, climbing McKinley and Mount Blackburn, and it seems like you came back another time to Talkeetna. Is that right, Bruce?
Yes. I had gone up to the University of Alaska. I told my brother, he had asked me if I wanted to stay on the family fruit farm or decide to come to Alaska. Well, I climbed up here, and I was I definitely wanted to come back to Alaska, but what was I going to do? Well, they needed teachers, and I decided to go back to the University of Alaska for a year and a half, and I had a degree in agriculture, but that didn't do me much good up here in fruit growing. Anyway, I came back as a teacher after 2 years in the Peace Corps in West Africa. I had joined the Peace Corps and gone to Sierra Leone for 2 years, and then came back in 63 and applied for a job teaching here, and they assigned me to Talkeetna. Well, I knew all about Talkeetna since I'd been here years before.
Right.
So I happily said yes to the contract. I think it was about $1,000 a month in those days. Anyway, I was very lucky to teach in the Little Red Schoolhouse along with Mary Carey. There was 17 students with a row of bookcases down the middle to divide the classroom. Then this is the second year they had a high school, and Mary had taught I think 8 the first year, and now we had 17. So it was a very good year for me starting out teaching here in Alaska. However, I was single, and I in those days there wasn't. There were 4 bars and no churches here in Talkeetna, and it wasn't very conducive to finding a wife, I felt. So I wanted to move further south where the gals were. And
where there were better pickings, huh?
A little bit better pickings, yeah, I guess you'd say.
There probably weren't many single females here in the early 60s.
Right, right. Well, I'm not a forward person, you know. I just pretty much keep to myself. And, we played Scrabble with Mildred Campbell, the primary school teacher, and of course Mary, and so we would play Scrabble and go on our fishing trips, and we never got skunked. And I remember one good trip up to Lake Chilatno, I believe it's called, and I thoroughly enjoyed my time in Talkeetna there. We had a hockey rink out there in the village square, where the kids could play hockey when it was cold. And it was an interesting year. to come from teaching in Sierra Leone, which was called the White Man's Grave because they lost so many early day missionaries there to Talkeetna here. But I moved down to Wasilla the next year and had my best year in teaching, a self-contained sixth grade class.
Oh,
there.
So you were here the one school year?
Yeah, I was just here the one school year.
64 was your... So you were here for the earthquake? Was
yes, yes.
And did
Mary,
you feel it in Talkeetna?
Pardon me?
Did you feel that earthquake in Talkeetna?
Well, I had a Volkswagen Bug, and I was on my way to ski Alyeska along with Mary Carey. And we were on the contractor's road here south of town. And we, you know, when it's slushy on a fairly warm March afternoon, why, no, we didn't feel anything. But when we got out to the road, we were taking a case of eggs of Milton Lichtenwalder's down to the Willow store. And when we deposited the eggs there, well, before we got to the store, we noticed all these cracks across the road. Where the separation of the bridges, you see, that caused these 2-inch cracks that everybody could see, of course. And so when we got to the store, we asked them, why the cracks? And they said, well, we've had an awful earthquake here. And we actually left the eggs there of Milton's and went on down to the Kinnick River Bridge, where they blocked us from going on into Anchorage because of the bridge problem that and the avalanches on the other side from Pioneer Peak. Mm-hmm. So we spent the night with a very kind gentleman. We took him home. He was a Dr. McKinley that was stranded on the other side, and he invited us to come home with him because he had a generator, and the power wasn't cut to his house. So he had it was up and running and going good.
Right.
But Talkeetna has changed a lot.
I was going to say, have you been back since that teaching year? Have you been back to visit?
I think just one time. Yeah, and I can't remember what year it was. Mm-hmm. But
and how? I mean, what do you? Well, obviously, there's a lot of newer buildings.
Yes.
Sort of changes?
Well, it was a mining and trapper town sort of thing in 63, and people just subsistence type of living here. Of course, I remember the B&K store where we got our groceries, and of course, most of the time why we had to depend on the railroad for freight and other things.
For supplies.
For supplies, yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. But what was your representative here then? Was it Sally? Oh, she was an outstanding student in our high school, and she later became your representative.
To state or federal or?
No, it wasn't federal. She was down in Palmer a lot.
Oh, Dorothy.
Yes,
Dorothy Jones.
It wasn't Sally. Yeah. It was Dorothy.
Dorothy. Mm-hmm.
Yes, Dorothy.
Mm-hmm. Jones.
Jones, right. Yeah. And, of course, Jay Hudson was in her class, too. So that, Rabinowitz? No, that's not that right. But there was a lot of nice kids here in the 63, 64.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. It was the second year they had the high school here. So they had to be good.
Okay, well, thanks, Bruce, for coming by. We've really appreciated the time you took to tell us some stories about the 50s and the 60s in Talkeetna. And you've been listening to Nuggets, a locally produced program focusing on the Northern Susitna Valley. Do you have a nugget you'd like to share? If you would like to host a show, be a guest on this program, or get involved in some other way, please call the station at 733-1700. You may also contact us through the website at ktna.org. I'm Holly, and I've been talking with Bruce Gilbert today, and thanks for listening to Nuggets.